To feature our first double feature of this morning. That will be a tribute to none other than Porter Wagoner, who passed away October 28th of 2007. In memory of the great wagon master, it's going to be two songs associated with the subject of death, yes, and murder, and Halloween. With that mentioned, we're going to pay tribute first of all to a song called Cold Dark Waters. Then we'll follow with one of his all-time classics called The Cold Hard Facts of Life. With that, I would like to welcome y'all in and wish y'all a happy belated Halloween. To all my ghostly goblins and listeners out there in radio world, welcome in, friends, and here we go with some great Porter Wagoner classics.
In tomorrow's newspaper, you'll read about me, but they won't tell the story I know. Or they'll only say he plunged yesterday to the cold dark waters below. I guess it all started the day that you love me so, and I never thought it would end in regret in the cold dark waters below. In a moment your conscience hurts so, all the tears that I've cried will be easy to hide in the cold dark waters below. Now I hear them running to try and stop me. They're shouting, oh, don't let him go. But it's far too late, and I'll soon meet my fate in the cold dark waters below. In the cold dark waters below. In town a day before I'd planned to, I smiled and said I'll sure surprise my wife. I don't think I'll phone, I'll just head on home, for I didn't know the cold hard facts of life. I passed a little wine store on the corner. I pictured pink champagne by candlelight. I stopped the car right then, got out and hurried in, my mind not on the cold hard facts of life. A stranger stood said, I'll take two bottles of your best. Her husband's out of town and there's a party. He winked as if to say, you know the rest. I left the store two steps behind the stranger. From there to my house, his car stayed inside. But it wasn't till he turned
into my drive that I learned I was witnessing the cold hard facts of life. Each time the noise came louder from within. And then I saw our bottle there beside me. And I drank a fifth of courage and walked in. Lord, you should have seen their frantic faces. They screamed and cried, please put away that knife. I guess I'll go to hell, or I'll rot here in this cell. But who taught who the cold hard facts of life? Who taught who the cold hard facts of life?
Yes, it's once again time to welcome our beloved howling werewolf of our program and our beloved furry mascot, the big bad wolf herself, Simbush the Wonder Husky, to our program this morning. With her collection of great Halloween-style songs, all on the subject of haunted houses. With that mentioned, I would like to play a collection of songs as picked out by our beloved Simbush the Wonder Husky. And yes, these are all to do with haunted houses. So we'll begin with a song that I recently came across and Simbush has picked out here called This Haunted House by none other than Mo Bandy. Then we'll follow with hearing a classic called This Haunted House. Of course, that's the same title as the previous song, but this time it's going to be by Coal Miner's Daughter, Miss Loretta Lynn. And we'll wrap up our ghostly favorites about haunted houses with a song that goes way back to the 1950s, and it's going to be Bank Holder, also known today as Sheb Woolley, and a song going out to our good friend Christy Woolley. She's Sheb's daughter, and it's going to be a song called Shudders and Screams. With that, I'd like to say Happy Halloween and Happy Hauntings to everyone listening in. And thank you, Simbush, you howling little werewolf, for your contribution to today's program. Welcome in, friends.
Me round midnight, then your shadow crossed in front of my nightlight. I've done my best to make it here in this house since you've been gone, but the ghost of your memory stayed home. I heard your voice from out in the kitchen, then I saw your face in the mirror while shaving. I had to fight to stay here, but darling, I failed. And tomorrow this haunted house goes up for sale. This haunted house I live in is getting to my mind. I'll sell it locked. If I don't make a dime, I saw some tears leave your eyes in that picture, the one that you gave me for our last anniversary. Someone else will have to check
for sale. Tomorrow this haunted house goes up for sale.
Watched you leave, that's how I know you're gone. But this heart of mine keeps telling me I'm wrong. I see your face before me every night. When I turn off the light, sometimes I hear you walk across the floor, and my arms reach out to hold you like before. I live for all the things we used to do. In this haunted house, I'm filled with love for you. This haunted house I'm living in is killing me. And the ghost of your love.
When I didn't make the payment on time. Just last night I walked by the old place and I heard a weird sounding hoot.
Hootie hoot.
There in the window, just up above me, old Igor was playing his flute. Shudders and screams come from the window of the house where we used to dwell. Frankenstein's monster project. And mashing around just inside the grounds was a chap with a stick through his neck.
He did the monster mash.
Shudders and screams come from the window of the house where we used to dwell. Bubbles and steam and lots of wild.
Looking in the lab late one night, when my eyes beheld
an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mess.
Hello, this is Sarah Karloff, daughter of Boris Karloff, and you've been listening to my good friend Johnny Woodlock on the way back, Haunted Hayride, Happy Halloween.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
Well, now, all you ghostly goblins and listeners on the Way Back with Johnny show, I'd like to welcome y'all into the Way Back here and salute some of the true Canadian Northern gems by even greater Canadian Northern legend. With that mentioned, I'd like to once again pay tribute to a collection of songs all associated with scary Halloween-style songs. With that mentioned, I would like to first of all play a song by the legendary Smiley Bates of Bent River, Ontario. It'll be a song going out to my friend Big Al Trainer, who worked alongside Smiley for many, many years. It'll be Genie's Afraid of the Dark. Then we'll follow with Ian Tyson and one of his later recordings, once he had his voice problems. But it's going to be called Charlie Goodnight's Grave. And we'll wrap up with another legend, this time by none other than Earl Haywood, and a song called One More on Satan's Side. With that, this one's about the old Black Donnellys of Lucan, Ontario. With that, I would like to welcome you all in and say happy belated Halloween wishes to each and every one of you listening in on your haunted radios out there. Welcome in, friends.
Her two little feet would come running into our bedroom almost every night. Her soft little face would be wet from her tears and her little heart pounding with fright. She'd hold out her arms and climb in beside us. In a small voice, we'd hear her remark, Mommy and Daddy, can I sleep here with you? 'Cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark. One day in the summer, we took some flowers to place on some old family graves. Jeannie said, Mommy, ain't it dark in the ground? Oh, Daddy, I'd be so afraid. Then she looked up at her mommy and me and said something that broke both our hearts. She said, when I die, please don't bury me, 'cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark. Jeannie was always afraid of the dark, and we never could understand why. 'Cause we looked after Jeannie with the very best of care, 'cause Jeannie was our only child. Perhaps it was death that she was so afraid of, 'cause it took her one dark, stormy night. I think we always knew that we'd never see Jeannie grown. It seemed that she was destined to die. But on Jeannie's grave we placed an eternal flame that glows and never loses its spark. And on the darkest of night there's always a light, 'cause Jeannie's afraid of the dark. Our Jeannie's afraid of the dark.
Flutter in the wind sighs over
Christmas goodnight's grave. Bandanas blue and yellow, all the shades of pallid dough. Where they come from, I do not know. Maybe riders on the wind. All along the fence line, like some old-time cowboy shrine. While rags flutter and the wind sighs over Charles Goodnight's grave.
This is the final chapter of a story filled with hate, of wickedness and violence, and those who met their fate. Everything is silent now out on the Roman line, but the last words ever spoken now forever haunt your mind. One more on Satan's side, one more on Satan's side. The gates are closed in heaven now, one more on Satan's side.
From his lab began to rock.
Hello, this is Lynn Lugosi Sparks, the granddaughter of Bela Lugosi, the original Dracula. You're listening to my friend Johnny Woodlock here on the Way Back Haunted Hayride. Happy Halloween and keep listening.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
And once again, it's that time in the program to welcome a very special guest of honor onto our Way Back with Johnny show. Now, this year marks the 85th anniversary of the world-famous and much-beloved Wizard of Oz. With that mentioned, a couple years ago, I got to sit down over the phone with a true Hollywood royalty, none other than Hamilton Meserve, who just happens to be the son of the Wicked Witch of the West actress Margaret Hamilton.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Who apparently was anything but a wicked witch. She was a very much beloved Hollywood actress and actress of the stage of Broadway. With that, we would like to travel back in time to 2023 and revisit this interview with Hamilton Meserve. Following this interview, we'll hear an all-time classic taken off the original Wizard of Oz soundtrack from 1939 and called Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and of course that was sung by none other than the sweetheart of the movies, Judy Garland. With that, here now is my good friend, all the way from Maine and also from 2023, Hamilton Meserve, the son of Margaret Hamilton. Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you, Mr. Meserve. How are you today?
I'm well.
That's great. So let's go back. What year was your mother born?
1902.
Okay. And what was childhood like for her growing up?
Brought up in Cleveland, Ohio, a prominent family. It was a traditional family, lived in a great big Victorian mass. She was one of four children.
Okay.
And had a conventional childhood. Went to school, halfway ground school in Cleveland, Ohio. I think it was more of a traditional Midwestern upper class family.
Okay, sure. And so how did she find her way into acting? I understand that she was actually a school teacher originally.
She went to halfway ground school in Cleveland, and she got the male lead in the school annual play.
Okay.
And that's when she said she got bitten by the acting bug, and came down to breakfast the next morning and announced to the family that she was going on the stage, and she would be going off to New York to seek her fortune. And her mother, in polite society in Cleveland, Ohio, if you were in the sort of middle to upper classes, young ladies did not go on the stage. That was not something it's done. And so there was a bit of an argument, and finally her mother said, okay, it looks like you really want to do this, but first you're going to have to go to college to be able to earn a living, because being an actress is a tough grind, and you've got to be able to support yourself, and therefore you need to go to college. And so off she went to Wheelock Kindergarten Preparatory School, the forerunner of Wheelock, and she got a degree in child education, and then taught in the Boston public schools really for almost 10 years until she finally got her break in when she was teaching at Rye Country Day School, and she was reading, helping somebody read for a part, and she was the other person, simply the dummy on the other side. And at the end of the reading, Rose Franklin, who was a famous playwright, said, actually, you were so good reading, I'm going to give you the part.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And that became another language, a play that opened in the late 20s, early 30s. And it was went on the road and did previews, and it was panned, and everybody thought it wasn't going to go, but they all wanted to open on Broadway. This was right during the bank holiday, during the Depression. And the producers came to the, they had a cast calling, and they said, look, we can't get access to our money because the banks are closed, and there's no way we can pay you. At this point, we don't know when we're going to be able to pay you, but you have a choice. We can wrap this thing up now and not open, and you go about your own way, or we can open. We don't know how we'll ever pay you, or whether we'll be able to pay you, but if you want to open, we'll go ahead. And of course, they all were desperate to open on Broadway, so they wanted to get their union card, and so they went ahead and opened, and to everybody's astonishment, it turned out to be a smash hit and ran for a year. And Mother was very successful, and she became the ingenue that season, the leading young actress on Broadway. And from there, she went to Hollywood to make the movie and came back and forth several times, and her career was off and running.
Okay, sure. So how did she get her iconic portrayal part of the Wicked Witch of the West in 1939?
Well, it was just another gig, mm-hmm. and her agent came to her and said, they want you for The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother was all excited because it was a major breakthrough, and she assumed it was going to be for the one of the witches, but she had no idea they wanted her for the
main part.
Wicked Witch.
Nice.
And she said, what do you mean? Why do they want that? You know, I'm not sure I want that. And I said, Maggie, your face is perfect for the witch, and this is a chance to do a great breakthrough in movies. And
yeah.
She finally said, okay, I will do it. But she was somewhat reluctant and a little bit taken aback because she didn't think that they were hiring her because she was, quote, ugly. Well, they said, we'll make your face ugly, and so it turned out it was the breakthrough, and
she's remembered
how she
even 85 years after, exactly.
Yeah, and she learned about it at a USC-UCLA football game in Los Angeles in the Coliseum, and at halftime, her agent came up to her and said, you got the part, so that was how it went from there.
I see, yeah. And I also understand that your mother, Margaret, also went through an accident in one of the fireball scenes.
Yes, she did. She was very interested in those days. Safety was not a high priority.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother said that it was quite often someone would actually be killed on a set.
Oh, wow.
For
yes.
some sort of accident. And the safety rules were very lax. And that became one of the things that they eventually fought to get turned about better rules. But she was in a scene of first opening scene in the Munchkin Village.
Yes.
And she's frustrated. She can't get the shoes from Dorothy, and so she decides to leave in a huff, and she backs up, and smoke comes out, and she disappears. Well, in those days, there were no, there were no people.
Stunt actors.
You did your own.
Mm-hmm.
You did your own work,
mm-hmm.
And so she had to back up into a square marked on the set.
Okay.
And smoke came out, engulfed her. She simultaneously, the trap door opened, and she dropped down through the trap door, and stagehands caught her down below, and she felt this warmth pass over her face, and they were actually doing a second shooting in order for a backup, and they'd come back from lunch, they were all tired, they were a little bit slow, and the way they got the smoke to disappear was they turned on jets of fire.
Oh, okay.
And so
yes.
Suddenly that killed the smoke, and in the meantime she dropped down through the floor, and she was gone. Well, they turned the fire jets on too soon.
I see.
To kill the smoke. and that's when she got third-degree burn on her hands and second-degree burn on her face. Mm. And she was out for 6 weeks recovering. And they said, well, what are you going to do about it? You going to sue or something? And they said, she said, darling, that was what they all called mm-hmm. each other, darling.
Yeah.
And you don't sue. If you do, you'll never get work again.
Exactly. Very true. Yes.
And so she recovered and came back. And then the first day she got back, they're having a scene where she flies a broom across the sky and saying, I'm going to get you, Dorothy.
Yeah.
And it was a broom that had a motor which propelled the broom across the sky. They were on a guy wire.
Oh, okay.
And she said, I've had one incident. I'm not going to do that again. So they had her double do it. And she was in the adjacent studio when she heard an explosion.
Oh.
And the gasoline engine on the broom that was preparing the broom across the sky blew up, and her double was in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
for six weeks or so. And that was sort of just these things happen.
Yes, and back in those days, they didn't really care about the safety, as you were mentioning. Yes, for sure.
That all became something that the Screen Actors Guild came out among the strikes they'd have was to get better safety regulations. But everything in those days, the actors did themselves. There weren't any sort of
doubles or
people who took care for them. You had to do it yourself.
Exactly. So looking back at Wizard of Oz and how beloved it is, what is your thoughts on this?
Well, it's become part of the cultural history of the United States.
Yes.
It's interesting. Snow White just come out in 1936,
mm-hmm.
and this is a whole new genre of sort of cartoonish presentations and make-believe, and it was quite a breakthrough for children, because heretofore make-believe in the United States consisted of written words, of books, of pictures, and this is the first time there'd been actually a movie presentation of make-believe, and the impact on the kids was just absolutely dramatic. But Snow White was not that scary. There were some evil people in mm-hmm. that movie, but the kids absorbed it. But when they got to The Wizard of Oz, they went one degree further as far as terror goes. And so I think it just dramatized the whole idea of make-believe. It's a whole new genre. And when they did the previews prior to the releasing the film, the impact of the witch was so dramatic that the kids literally were running out of the theater screaming.
Oh, wow.
They were
yeah.
just holy. And of course, this is a whole different thing. This is not sitting with your parents reading a book.
That's for sure.
A dark theater. Mm-hmm. It's dark. It's quickly paced. And the kids never know when the witch is going to show up. And they became traumatized. So Mother's role was cut back to 12 minutes. It was almost 20 minutes long.
Yes.
As it originally was done. And so she only appears on the screen for 12 minutes. But the point is that in the story, she's very much there in the background, and you never know when she's going to pop out.
Exactly.
And so the kids were
That's
just
true.
Traumatized
mm-hmm.
by that. So they had to cut her performance way back. And I think it took a long time for the whole movie industry to adjust to this type of terror. And the movie itself never was fully accepted by kids until it went on television. And that was in the late 1950s.
Okay, yes. Makes sense.
And once you as a child could sit in your mother's lap in the living room with a light on and a dog on the couch and,
mm-hmm.
and family around and commercial breaks and whatnot.
It was more relaxed.
It was more relaxed, and kids began to relax, to accept it. And
yes.
then once mothers saw, Mom, the kindergarten teacher, Siri, once mothers saw that the kids could take it, then they adopted the film, and then it became famous, and it became a pastime. But it wasn't until it got on television, and the terror was mitigated by the fact that you're sitting in your home and your family around and dogs on the couch and
exactly.
all that type of thing, that the kids
sure.
could take it, and then it became the pastime.
Now, she was also a well-respected actress outside of Oz. What was her life like after The Wizard of Oz?
Her true love was acting.
Mm-hmm.
And her true home, she felt, was Broadway. And that's where she eventually ended up after. She was, I guess, that was 1939. And she stayed in Southern California so her son could finish grammar school. But then when 1950 came, she headed right back to Broadway. That's where she spent the rest of her life. And the acting was her real genre, not the movie making,
okay.
But actual plays.
Okay.
And that's where her reputation among her peers developed. She was known as a very fine acting actress. And so her love was Broadway. She spent every summer on and local stage and summer stock, and she did national tours, and that's what she lived for.
Okay,
and,
sure.
And so she sort of tolerated movies, but Hollywood was not a friendly place for a single woman with a child to be brought up, and so she wanted to get back to New York, and there's a family of actors. That whole tradition in New York is very comforting, very warming, and that's where she loved to be, and that's how she ended up the rest of her life.
Well, tell us about your mother's thoughts on the sad passing of Judy in 1969.
Well, she had a special relation with her during the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they befriended each other. Both were going through difficult divorces.
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of a mother, or at least a great aunt to Judy during this filming.
Okay.
And she tells a story which really had an impact on her life and how she then treated me as the child.
Yes.
Judy came to her one day and was all excited and said she showed her this beautiful new white dress, and she was so excited that she was going to be allowed. She had done all her education on the set, but she always wanted to be part of a normal a child. And she was involved with Hollywood High, and they were going to let her participate in the graduation of her class at Hollywood High, and she was so excited that she was going to be like a normal teenager. And at the last minute, MGM canceled her appearance there and sent her with Mickey Rooney on a countrywide tour. I think it was for Babes in Arms or something, and she could not go, and Judy was absolutely crushed, and Mother sort of sympathized with her, but she saw that her life as a teenager, as a child, was totally dominated by the studio.
Yes, exactly. They fully controlled her.
And I got to go to the set a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And I was running around on the set of Wizard of Oz, and I was a little towhead blonde kid, pretty cute looking, and there was a tradition in those days that the studios would sign up the children of their star actress in order to be sure that no other studio got them, and they would be building up a team of potential actors, and they came to Mother and said they wanted to sign me a contract, and you know, I was 3 years old, I didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother said over her dead body,
yes,
she would never allow that to happen. This is no life for a child. And so my whole childhood was in Beverly Hills, was actually a wonderful existence of swimming pools and beaches and softball and Cub Scouts and all that. He made absolutely sure that my upbringing was normal and completely protected from the business. And I knew that something about she was something going on in her acting world, but I was completely wrapped up as a child in school.
And shielded from.
And she shielded, and she would show up every Sunday for the Cub Scout baseball games, and she would take me on trips and whatnot. But she completely protected me from Hollywood. And as soon as I got through graduating eighth grade in 1950, she immediately sold the house, and we all moved back to New York.
Okay, I see, yeah. Okay, and how has Hollywood changed, in your opinion, during or since that era?
Since that era? Well, it's no longer, in my opinion, emphasis on acting. It's much more mechanical. It's much more contrived. And so it's interesting. Her acting was basically, well, I would call the actor had to be able to, well, they call repertoire. They should be able to take on any part,
yes,
any type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so where she thrived on that, and she spent a lot of time in the summers on summer stock going around the country. And that's where you studied a part in the afternoon and then put on another play at night, and you had to be very versatile. And today, she says, repertoire acting is gone out of style, and it's very much individualist, and it's the important thing.
Yes, true.
So she found that her ability in Hollywood became outdated, and that's another reason why she went back to Hollywood, to Broadway to do acting, and that was her whole life.
So in wrapping up today, what is your thoughts on how you would like to see The Wizard of Oz or also your mother's legacy continued into the decades to come?
Well, I think it will continue as it's developed now, mm-hmm. and it's the part of history of the movies in Hollywood,
yes.
and it's legendary, and I think that's how it will continue, and I don't see it paling at all. It's just part of the whole history of entertainment and the development of movies. The irony is that she didn't really value that role. She was happy to do it.
Yes.
But for her, the most important thing was acting, and some of her triumphs was on the stage
in Broadway
in New York, and
yeah.
and getting good reviews there and developing. She also spent a lot of time in New York on television when television still was centered in New York City before it moved to Hollywood, and so she had quite a reputation in television in the early days. So, but I think the great thing is the legacy of that role,
mm-hmm.
and the whole other aspect of her life was basically reaching out to people and helping people and being involved in charities, and the other thing that she spent a lot of time doing was she was very concerned about make-believe
exactly.
and the impact
yes,
on kids,
for sure.
And she spent a lot of time making public appearances, and her famous one was
Fred Rogers' Neighborhood, for instance.
Fred Rogers, where she comes out and puts on the uniform, and she was so concerned that kids would understand what make-believe was all about, and she would get down on her knees, and when a child would approach with parents and be absolutely terrified, and have the child touch her face and see, I'm just a nice old lady, and you shouldn't be afraid. And she felt, as the teacher in her was, that the trauma that kids were going through with that character, she worked a lot. So she would make Christmas readings, and she would do all sorts of things to try to convince people that the character was a character, and there was a big difference between that and the human being that they saw in person. And she spent a lot of time promoting that idea that make-believe is something you have to understand. It is make-believe.
Exactly.
And then she
yes.
now, so she would hope that character continues as it is part of the legend of Hollywood and entertainment, but that people will understand that there were human beings behind those characters.
Behind those characters. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Fun doing.
And you have a good day. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow. Why, oh, why can't I?
And I do hope y'all enjoyed that interview with our good friend and son of Margaret Hamilton. Hamilton may serve. Now it's once again time to pay tribute to our beloved companion and our furry member of our morning team. That, of course, is none other than Gunny Arp Dashhound, the shortest member of our team, but who makes it up with an even longer personality and mile-long heart. With that mentioned, Gunny's got a little bit of a joke here for y'all today. It seems there was these two people sitting at a coffee table together in the living room, and there came a knock to the door. The one got up, went to the door, there was nobody there. Came back, and he says to the other one, "I wish they would stop doing that." 5 minutes later, the knock came again, and there's at the mat two wieners without any meat or anything on them. And the punchline goes that the other one sitting with the man asked him, "Who is it?" And the other guy says, "It's two Halloweenies." Well, with that, that's the story of our Halloweenies. And anyway, I'd like to share some songs by our beloved companion and our little friend, Gunny the Dashhound, this morning as we pay tribute to Halloween once again. With that, we are going to pay tribute to Johnny Wright called Rest in Peace. With that, I would like to welcome Gunny to our program this morning and wish her a very happy Halloweeny of a Halloween. Welcome in, friends.
Rest in peace, my heart passed away. I needed you so, but you wouldn't stay. At least have respect for the deceased. Say goodbye. Rest in peace.
Well, I can't believe you could hurt me this way.
Friends, once again, I would like to pay tribute to the darker side of the Holy Bible as I pay tribute to one of those all-time classic ghostly favorites of the golden age of gospel. With that mentioned, we were going to pay tribute to a song called Lonely Tombs, and is by none other than the legendary voice of the hillbilly Shakespeare, Hank Williams. With that, I would like to welcome y'all in and say we'll visit with y'all on the other side of the hour. Welcome in, friends.
As all the boys and staff, one of the prettiest hymns that's ever been written. Lonely Tombs.
Mm-hmm.
strolling one day in a lonely graveyard when a voice from the tomb seemed to say, I once lived as you lived, walked and talked as you talked, but from earth I was soon called away. Seem to whisper and say, living man, you must soon follow me. And I thought as I gazed on that cold marble slab, what a sad, lonely place that must be. Oh, those tombs. Son, I'm at rest with the Savior above. I am safe in my heavenly home. Oh, those tombs.
Oh, those tombs.
Lonely tombs.
Lonely tombs seem to send a large and a
thank you, boys, for a fine song.
Hello, friends. This is a creeper, Jonathan Breck, from the original horror classic Jeepers Creepers. You're listening to your ghost of a host, Johnny Woodlock, here on the Way Back Haunted Hayride. Keep it tuned here, and happy Halloween.
Now, all you ghostly goblins out there in radio world, this here is your old host, or should I say ghost of a host, Johnny Woodlock, here on the Double Trouble and Boil and Trouble, second edition of the Way Back with Johnny Woodlock's Haunted Hayride this year. With that mentioned, we're still coming to you via the Woodlock Ranch and Studios in Cornwall, Ontario. We can also be heard via our Haunted Hayride through CFRC 1019 FM from the Limestone City of Kingston, Ontario, Canada. And we are also proudly carried over www.oshawarocks.com, over the internet and spiderweb, throughout the Durham County and Greater Toronto area. We can also be heard via our channel on YouTube at Way Back with Johnny Woodlock on YouTube as well. With that shared, I would like to once again share a double feature here this morning, this time by our birthday boy, who is celebrating his 88th birthday yesterday, the 1st of November. That, of course, is none other than the legendary whispering po' boy of country music, Bill Anderson. Now, Bill recorded two rather spooky-type songs during his career, as well as recording, but also wrote many songs as well. With that mentioned, we're going to pay tribute to a song called Candy Apple Red, and then we'll follow with The First Mrs. Jones. With that, I would like to send these out to Bill today down there in Nashville, Tennessee, and just wish him a happy...